is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 38 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Out at the airport, they have 70% humidity, west winds at 3 miles per hour, and 10 full miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for a 20% chance of rain after 3 this afternoon. High near 41 today, with west winds to 10, turning to the south this afternoon. And look for rain tonight, too, mainly before 3 in the morning. Low around 38 overnight tonight, with southeast winds to 15, turning to the southwest after midnight, could gust as high as 25. And mostly sunny skies tomorrow after a chance of rain in the morning. Mostly sunny on Thursday, too. And Saturday. Coming up on the Midday Report, a U.S. Coast Guard helicopter has crashed near Petersburg. According to a new federal climate report, communities across Alaska will have to learn to adapt.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden is due to arrive shortly in San Francisco for a high-stakes meeting with the head of China, a country Americans widely view as the greatest security threat facing the United States, according to a Pew Research Center survey. Biden and his counterpart Xi Jinping are attending the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. Biden and Xi are slated to meet tomorrow. Russia's war in Ukraine is expected to be high on the agenda, as will the Israel-Hamas war. Biden is sounding optimistic about the release of additional hostages being held in Gaza. NPR's Asma Khalid reports Biden's comments come as the Biden administration has been seeking a pause in the war to allow potential safe passage.
The president would not comment on a report that Israel and Hamas are close to a deal to release a large number of hostages, but he did sound hopeful.
I've been talking with the people involved every single day. I believe it's going to happen, but I don't want to get any details.
His message to the family members of hostages? Hang in there, we're coming. Biden's top Middle East official is on a multi-day trip to Europe and the Middle East, which includes a stop in Qatar to focus on efforts to secure the release of hostages. There are an estimated 240 hostages being held in Gaza. That includes a 3-year-old American toddler. Asma Khalid, NPR News, the White House.
Reinforcing Israel's claims, White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says the U.S. has its own intelligence that Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad have stored weapons underneath Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza.
Now, to be clear, we do not support striking a hospital from the air, and we do not want to see a firefight in a hospital where innocent people, helpless people, sick people are simply trying to get the medical care that they deserve, not to be caught in a crossfire. Hospitals and patients must be protected.
Back in Washington, political rancor was on full display in different corners of the Capitol today. A fistfight almost broke out in the U.S. Senate between Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen and the head of the Teamsters Union, Sean O'Brien, in the middle of a hearing on labor unions.
Sir, this is a time, this is a place. If you want to run your mouth, we can be two consenting adults. We can finish it here.
Okay, that's fine. Perfect.
You want to do it now?
I'd love to do it right now.
Well, stand your butt up then.
You stand your butt up.
Oh, hold on. Oh, stop it.
Is that your solution, every problem?
No, sit down. Sit down.
Look at you.
You're a United States senator. Sit down.
Active.
That's Independent Senator Bernie Sanders scolding his Republican colleague, as heard on MSNBC. On the House side, GOP Representative Tim Burchett accused former Speaker Kevin McCarthy of elbowing him in the hallway.
You got no guts. You did so. They sat there, and the reporter said it right there. What kind of chicken move is that? You're pathetic, man. You are so pathetic.
Burchett was among those who supported McCarthy's ouster as Speaker. From Washington, this is NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
A U.S. Coast Guard helicopter crashed around 10:40 p.m. last night on Reed Island and Farragut Bay, about 22 miles northwest of Petersburg. There were 4 crew members aboard, and all survived. 2 personnel were severely injured in the crash. The other 2 received only minor injuries. The crew of the downed Jayhawk helicopter were on their way from Air Station Sitka to assist the Lydia Marie, a 55-foot commercial crabbing vessel, which was taking on water near Farragut Bay. Following the helicopter crash, U.S. Coast Guard cutters Elderberry and Douglas Denman responded to the flooding vessel. At the time of the initial response, the crew of the Lydia Marie had contained the flooding to a manageable level. Several agencies, including the Petersburg Search and Rescue and EMS, came to assist the downed helicopter. Air Station Sitka sent another helicopter to take all 4 crew members to Petersburg Medical Center. They were later evacuated to Seattle for a higher level of care. District 17 spokesperson Petty Officer First Class Shannon Kearney told KFSK that the Coast Guard doesn't have any preliminary information on the cause of the crash.
We are working to launch a full investigation, and any information that we get from the investigation will be forthcoming with.
Petersburg Search and Rescue volunteers reported strong winds and snowfall in the area. According to the National Weather Service, there was reduced visibility across the area from rain and snowstorms and wind speeds that reached up to 45 miles per hour. The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, a partially government-funded organization focused on promoting the state's seafood, held its all-hands-on-deck conference in Anchorage earlier this month. Some of the industry's top experts presented on the state of the market. Kirsten Dobroth is the Alaska reporter for Undercurrent News, a commercial fishing and seafood trade magazine. She was at the conference and sat down with KMXT's Brian Venois to chat about the state of the seafood industry.
So, Kirsten, this was ASME's annual meeting. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like? What would you say were some of the overarching themes at the conference?
Well, the big consensus was definitely how bad market conditions are across Alaska's fisheries right now. There's been a lot of attention on low base prices paid out to fishermen for salmon this year, but I think it's worth pointing out that ex-vessel and wholesale prices, so that's money paid to harvesters and then money that's paid to processors for bulk product, they're at some of the lowest levels they've been at in decades, if not ever, across multiple species in Alaska, including salmon. Prices have crashed across the pollock sector and also for typically really lucrative species like sablefish or black cod. So that really set the tone for the conference.
So would you say that was kind of like the elephant in the room?
Oh, definitely. I heard the situation compared probably a dozen times to a term fishermen in Alaska are familiar with, a willowa, which is kind of like a violent storm that comes down to the sea suddenly from the mountains. ASME's board of directors published an open letter before the conference even began, citing what they called extraordinary circumstances that have led to this price collapse. In the letter, they said fishermen were having trouble making boat payments right now. On the other hand, processors are also struggling with cash flow. It painted a pretty dire picture, and that was really a pervasive theme at this conference, both how to navigate this historic situation that's hitting pretty much every species in Alaska, and then what the year ahead might look like.
And to zoom in a little bit, salmon fishers especially have been pretty outspoken about frustration over pricing this year, and processors have been pretty quick to blame those low prices on huge hauls over the last few years. How much is that playing into things, and are there any updates on moving that older inventory?
Yeah, both of those things, huge harvests and leftover inventory, has continued to be difficult, and again, not just for salmon. But there are a lot of market conditions that are making moving that product really tough. Inflation is a huge one. One analyst who presented at the ASME conference pointed out that grocery prices are up 30% since before the pandemic. Other panelists at the event talked about struggles with the Japanese economy. That's been a big trading partner for the Alaska seafood industry. The ASME Board of Directors letter I mentioned before also outlined ongoing effects of the trade war with China. That's also historically been a big market for seafood products from Alaska. Russian had big harvests of pollock and pink salmon this year, just like in Alaska. Another big takeaway from the conference is that consumers have just changed since the pandemic, and that also presents a real challenge.
And you kind of mentioned these trade wars, and especially let's talk about the one with Russia. There's been a lot of finger-pointing at them and their role in this. Alaska's congressional delegation has said part of the issue is that while Russia's embargoed American seafoods, U.S. consumers are still buying Russian products after they get processed in places like China.
Right. Senators Murkowski and Sullivan and Representative Peltola have continued a pretty united push to close this processing loophole you mentioned of Russian seafood, which is banned in the U.S., entering the domestic market by way of processing facilities in China. They have reiterated that demand in interviews and at every gathering of seafood industry people I've been to this year, including during pre-taped remarks at the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute conference. Senator Dan Sullivan's office has indicated recently there's been some progress with that, but Congress is also on a time crunch to fund the government by November 17th, so it's unclear what will happen by then.
Yeah, and ASME's focus is obviously marketing and stirring demand, including developing stronger consumer bases here in the States. Have you heard of any interesting efforts or bold strategies to build more interest either domestically or internationally?
Well, a bright spot domestically is purchases from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for domestic food aid programs. So far, USDA has purchased more than $200 million worth of mostly Alaskan pollock and salmon products this year. But there's also been a push across the industry, and this is domestically and internationally, to increase some sort of Alaska or product of USA labeling standard. And that was a big conversation piece at the conference. Several analysts who study consumer behavior told attendees that people look for products that say they're wild caught or Alaskan when they're in the store. And it's worth, in that same point, to point out that Senator Murkowski has also been very vocal about creating some sort of an Alaska-specific brand.
So with all this said, what do you think were some of the most important things for our listeners, especially fishermen, that they need to know about ASME's efforts and kind of the state of seafood markets in general?
Well, one thing that came up several times, including during ASME's board of directors meeting the last day of the conference, was the need to better communicate with the fleet, both market conditions so commercial fishermen know what to expect, and also what's actually happening to market Alaska seafood products. But like I said before, this is a really tough time for the entire industry. Prices are down for just about everyone. And I think the biggest takeaway that I heard was that there are a lot of people working on how to get through it.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today, Kirsten.
Thanks, Brian.
Today, the Senate Rules Committee will consider and mark up a resolution that would allow the Senate to approve more than 300 military promotions. It comes as Senator Tommy Tuberville, a Republican from Alabama, has spent the past 9 months blocking the promotions to oppose the Department of Defense's abortion policy. Ahead of the markup, Senator Dan Sullivan, a fellow Republican, said that while he does not agree with the Biden administration's policy on abortion rights, Tuberville's block punishes people who are not involved in the dispute.
These officers have nothing to do with the dispute. They're apolitical. They, even if they got confirmed, they would not have anything to do with it. They'd have no authority to resolve the problem.
Sullivan says the officers awaiting promotions had served their country honorably and that the block was demoralizing.
It's very obvious right now that the military has a morale and retention problem. This is not helping with morale and retention at all.
A resolution from the Senate would allow a simple majority to circumvent Tuberville's block. It will take a total of 60 votes, including a minimum of 9 more Republican votes, for the resolution to pass. Communities will have to adapt as melting caused by climate change transforms the environment across Alaska. That's the prevailing message from a new federal climate report out today. White House National Climate Advisor Ali Zaidi introduced the fifth National Climate Assessment in a press conference.
The National Climate Assessment provides us really both the topography of the risk as it cascades through our economy, touching every sector, every segment of the economy, as well as the atlas of opportunity.
For Alaska, some of the most pressing risks are posed by declining sea ice, thawing permafrost, and erosion. And those environmental changes threaten health, food security, livelihood, and cultural practices. The Alaska chapter of the assessment shows how human-caused climate change can make existing problems like poor sanitation and limited housing stock even worse, especially in rural communities. And for a state that already faces high grocery prices and food insecurity, declining sea ice and changing weather patterns will disrupt both commercial and subsistence harvests, with documented declines in salmon, crab, and berries. These changes are more deeply felt by Alaska Native communities, where traditional foods are important for cultural and spiritual well-being. Aradi Probacker is the director of the White House Office of Science and Technology. She says laying out these problems in the assessment will help Americans in Alaska and elsewhere form their adaptation plans.
Much more work is needed to fully overcome the climate crisis. And for all the work that's still ahead, we need a foundation of clear, factual, rigorous data and evidence. This is how people across America can prepare for and respond to the climate crisis.
Many municipal and tribal governments are already making plans to deal with Alaska's changing climate, but the assessment emphasizes the need to support rural tribal communities and engage indigenous knowledge holders along the way. A group of explosives experts traveled to Cold Bay late last month. They were responding to a report by a local hunter who found what appeared to be a large unexploded artillery munition. The potential explosive was found in the middle of the federally protected Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant Tyrone Powell is a bomb disposal technician and team leader for the Cold Bay mission. He confirmed the hunter did find an unexploded military round. The shell was about 12 inches in diameter and about 4 feet long.
Yeah, it's big artillery. When we pulled it out of the ground, it weighed probably 600-700 pounds. It took four of us to pull it out.
Powell says that type of round was first manufactured in 1943, but could have been built any time up to the 1990s.
What was interesting about the round, it was actually split open, so there was no more explosives on the inside. So it had to have been underneath the ground for a pretty long time for that to happen.
The military team used explosives to dispose of the munition where it was found in the middle of the refuge, which contained some of the world's largest eelgrass beds. The refuge says the detonation occurred away from the majority of migrating waterfowl and was not near the eelgrass beds where endangered brants feed. An historic cannery on the west side of Cook Inlet has been officially entered into the National Registry of Historic Places. KDLL's Riley Board has more.
Brothers Abe and Eli Porter are more than just the owners of the Snug Harbor Cannery. They have deep roots there. Their grandfather moved to the Kenai Peninsula from Oregon at 20 and worked as a commercial fisherman in Chinitna Bay.
When the cannery started, he actually fished one of the boats for the cannery, Snug 12, and my dad and he fished the boat together.
Snug Harbor began as a clammery around the turn of the century, then evolved into a fish trap cannery before working directly with a fleet of boats and eventually individual fishermen. By the 80s, the cannery became obsolete as facilities on the east side of the inlet grew.
Those canneries that were popping up all over the state have such a rich history because they were there before there was really many cities in the state. And that's what brought a lot of people up here. A lot of people from other countries came to work the canneries and send what little money they had home. And this cannery in particular was built, like many of them, to house many, many different people.
The cannery transferred ownership and sat mostly unused after that. Just out of college in the early 2000s, the Porter brothers intervened.
And the cannery was just kind of slowly deteriorating. They mothballed it, and it was sat there for years and years, and we just watched it deteriorate, and we were like, well, maybe there's something we can do, and we put in an offer.
They've been working on restoring it ever since, which hasn't been an easy task. The site of the cannery is only accessible during the warmer months by boat or float plane. And both brothers also work full-time jobs, Abe as a Kenai firefighter and Eli as a teacher at Nikiski Middle High School.
Every time we go over there after the winter, we're always kind of biting our nails. Okay, is everything still standing?
The cannery is made up of more than a dozen buildings, including bunkhouses, processing facilities, and a store, all connected by a boardwalk. There's also a dock, part of the cannery's history as the only deep water port on the west side of the inlet. The whole property is on wooden pilings.
So we started with what's called the Freebrock House, which was the owner's house, and that needed restoration, and that's where we put a lot of pilings, a lot of care into that place, a lot of forms poured, and then going in and renovating the inside of the house as well. And then we moved to the store and above the store into the bookkeeper's apartment and renovated all that, put a lot of pilings in, poured a lot of forms for that.
Abe and Eli say they've been learning as they go along, with the help of many carpentry expert friends.
And we're actually coming back around to the, well, I think I already fixed that, but that was 20 years ago. So now here I am fixing it again.
The porters aren't just restoring the historic site. They've also been turning it into a tourist destination for sightseeing and fishing to offset the costs of the restoration. That's meant converting historic bunkhouses into modern lodging and installing a new commercial kitchen. It operates under the name Snug Harbor Outpost.
Yeah, I think it's always been in our mind that in order for this to work, it's going to have something that brings people here, because a part of that is we just want to share it with people too. We want people to see how cool it is. It's an amazing place.
After tackling much of the construction, the porters decided to seek historical recognition. Spearheaded by Abe's wife Mariah, last year the team behind Snug Harbor set out to achieve a designation from the National Register of Historic Places. That recognition brings attention to the site and opens it up to grant money. Mariah says that process was pretty painstaking.
I mean, there was write-ups for every single building, and there's quite a few buildings over there.
14, to be exact, plus 2 sites, 3 structures, and an object. With the help of a state historian, Mariah applied first for a nomination through the State Historical Commission, then moved on to the national scale. The cannery officially received the designation in September. A press release from the state's Department of Natural Resources describes the 104-year-old cannery complex as an important part of the inlet's commercial fishing history, notable for the diverse populations of women, Filipinos, and Alaska Natives who worked at the facility.
I think it opens up awareness, first of all, how special this place is and the historical value that's there. And I think it will hopefully turn some heads of some key people that might be able to, you know, give us some ideas or direction on how to keep this place alive.
The family is now applying for an Alaska Maritime Heritage Preservation Grant to expand their financial resources for reconstruction. Their next project is the restoration of the fisherman's bunkhouse, which will allow more guests to stay at the cannery. Mariah says the family's investment in the cannery is still about their personal connection.
Like, having our kids over there, it's amazing. We're bringing up the 4th generation of commercial fishermen out of Snug Harbor. That's amazing.
In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
Kodiak College Student Government is hosting a pasta and sauce drive with the help of many Kodiak retailers. Between November 11th and November 26th, you can enter your name in to win an epic prize by dropping off a donation of a box of pasta and a jar of pasta sauce to one of these locations.
Hi, Mark Marine, Kodiak Island Brewery, Bases Loaded, Bella Bronze Body Spa, Kodiak Power Sports, Taze Wellness, and Grand Slam Toy Store.
Though not a drop-off location, special thanks to Islander Bookshop.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the 14th day of November, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 8:52. It will set again at 4:54, giving us 8 hours and 2 minutes of precious daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 11 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high for this date was 54 degrees set in 2013, and our record low was 9 degrees set in chilly 1975, which has a record for a lot of low temperatures. 38 degrees right now in Kodiak under fair skies, west winds at 3 miles per hour at the airport where they have 70% humidity, and they continue to have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for a 20% chance of rain after 4 p.m. this afternoon, with increasing clouds as the day goes by, High near 41, west winds to 10, turning to the south. Rain tonight, mainly before 4 a.m., with low around 39, southeast winds to 15, gusting to 25. And for tomorrow, sunny skies eventually after a 50% chance of rain in the morning. Mostly sunny for Thursday, too, just a 30% chance of showers followed by partly sunny skies on Friday and mostly sunny for Saturday and Sunday. We have a high tide coming up. Our next high tide here on the east side will be at 1:47 p.m. and be 10.2 feet here. And the low tide will be at 8:37 p.m. and be minus 1 foot, minus tide at 8:37 tonight. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 2:21 this afternoon and be 15.8 feet in Larson Bay, followed by a low tide at 9:06 p.m. of minus 2.1 feet. Mariners, be aware we do have a gale warning for tomorrow for our east side, Marmot Island to Sitkanak, out to 15 miles. Southwest 15 today, becoming southeast this afternoon, 4 foot seas building to 5 feet tonight. For tomorrow on our east side, southwest 35, 7 foot seas building to 11 feet. And for Wednesday night, southwest 35 with 14 foot seas. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory for tomorrow. Southwest 15 becoming variable 10 this afternoon, seas to 4 feet. East 20 tonight with 4 foot seas. And tomorrow on our west side, southwest 15 increasing to 25 knots, 3 foot seas building to 8 feet in the afternoon. And for Wednesday night in the Shelikof, southwest 35, that's 3-5, and seas to 11 feet. Today at 4 p.m., join Diet and the Love Soldiers, along with the Kodiak Arts Council, for their community outreach, Music from an Indigenous Perspective, with a workshop and performance. Diet will be guiding the community through a musical encounter of Indigenous identity and understanding, using a combination of traditional stories and songs, as well as movement. Diet seeks to build an appreciation of Indigenous music. This event is free for everyone and will be happening at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium Band Room. Again, that's at 4 p.m. today at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium Band Room. Sounds like a lot of fun. Also at 4 p.m. today, the latest edition of Scuttlebutt, the Galley Tables Workshop for Youth. That's going on between 4 and 5:30 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library's Craft Room today. It's a free weekly storytelling workshop for students grades 9 through 12. For more information, call 907-486-7396. Also today, the KMXD Board of Directors will be holding their next monthly meeting. That's happening at 6 p.m. at the KMXT building here at 620 Egan Way. The meeting is open to the public, and members are always encouraged to attend. For more information, call us on the phone at 486-3181, or you can get a Zoom link by emailing gm@kmxt.org. On Thursday, the Hospice and Palliative Care of Kodiak will be having an open house featuring Navigating the Holidays After Loss. Individuals and family grieving a loved one this holiday season are invited to attend. That's happening Thursday from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library. It's a family-friendly remembrance, activities and crafts, and refreshments. That's at 4 to 5:30 p.m. 6 to 7 p.m., they will be offering tools, resources, and meaningful discussions with the bereavement facilitator, Julie Belden. Call 907-512-0600 for more information. And the American Association of University Women's annual Holiday Bazaar will be happening Saturday, November 18th this year. That's happening at 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Kodiak High School gym. To reserve your booth space, you'll need to email somebody. Email Kathy at katdaquilania@yahoo.com. That's katdaquilania@yahoo.com, and American Association of University Women. If you have a phone number, we wouldn't mind having that.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.